Buddhist Summer School, Monday afternoon, 4th September 1978. We have here one very good question. Could you please give us some idea of how the Absolute moves us along the path towards perfected man? If each separative individual consciousness dissolves at death, is there a sense in which something is reborn or not, to carry the development a stage further, or does the development take place through the evolution of the collective consciousness of humanity? I wish I could meet the Absolute and ask him how he moves us along. I think I understand what is implied in that. The word Absolute is a little bit too abstract in this context. If we use that word signifying what it really stands for, that which is the completely absolved, that's a fundamental way of looking at that word, the Absolute. Completely absolved. If it is completely absolved, there is no possibility, at least for me, to present a conceptual picture or any verbal formulation about the Absolute. See, this is one of the difficulties when we ask the very deep fundamental questions. Now, what follows afterwards is very important. If each separative individual consciousness dissolves at death, is there a sense in which something is reborn or not, to carry the development a stage further? Now, when we use the word something, there is always the implication of identifiable entity. Something. But there is no thing which does not undergo change. When the change has reached a certain point, it becomes quite unrecognizable. It is indeed, the changed thing is related to all that brought about the change. All the forces that brought about the change are themselves changing forces. Now, there is another point involved in this. All these forces are interpenetrating forces. They don't retain identifiable entity or any sort of identifiability beyond a certain short span in time. Being wholly interpenetrating, the universal activity is one of such completeness that it becomes impossible in a space of time, in a period of time, to track, to keep track of any separate part of it. When the separative individual consciousness dissolves at death, involves the complete dissolution of the whole organism. That is, the organism consisting of rupa, vedna, sannyas, sankhara, and vijnana. They all hang together. Let any one of them quite disappear, die in the real sense, all the rest vanish with it. That structure is no longer that structure. You see? Therefore, the arbitrarily postulated I, the me, which is the work of the klishta manas, the defiled mind, which projects this misconception of a particular separate ego as such, which goes on and on, you see, that goes with it. If that goes, the label stuck upon that organism, Firoz Mehta or so and so, has also gone with it. Where are you going to find him? You can't. So now, when we use the word something, we have the association with identifiable entity. But the death of the organism, the whole organism as such, means the complete dissolution of that identifiability. I say all this because when we use the words rebirth or reincarnation, when we use the other old words which the Greeks coined, transmigration, metempsychosis, palingenesis, and so forth, you see, I think that practically exhausts the list. When they coined all those words, there was always the underlying belief of a continuing I, which reached a peak point, a goal. And if you asked, thereafter what? Well, thereafter, well, you are an immortal God, and that's that. The story doesn't go any further. You know how the Buddha, in one of the long discourses, gives an account of how in the beginning there was nothing, you see, and then one of the great gods arises, and he drops out of the sphere of radiance, and so on, and then all sorts of other gods and so on come into being, and human beings come into existence, and so on and so on. There's a certain tongue in the cheek and sense of humor aspect to that account in the Digha Nikaya. So that this idea of a something and rebirth or reincarnation is a mistaken concept born out of our defiled manas, the klishta manas, projecting an entity ego. Now, if we can be free of that state of defilement of the mind, defilement not in the sense of being dirty or moralistically evil or anything, but the mind is imperfect. The intelligence is faulty, put it that way, you see. If we can divest ourselves, free ourselves from that limitation, then we shall see things in a different light. The changes that you and I, with our limited vision, our limited sensitivities, can see and experience are in actual fact both particular changes in the immediacy of time and space and simultaneously universal changes. If one's consciousness really became that of the enlightened state, then you would sense the whole process altogether as a universal process, not as an individual process, not as a separate individual process. This is very important. If we had universal consciousness, then whatsoever happened in individual atomic terms would be, you would be conscious of it also as non-atomistic, in field terms, the whole field in which the cosmos manifests and functions, the entire field. For example, I take it on a small scale. Changes take place within our own bodies, don't they? Now, the movement of the gaseous elements composing our body is quickest of all. Perhaps the swiftest reactions, the swiftest activities are our nerve activities, nerve functioning. These things can be measured scientifically, their speed, actual speed as such. Then there are the gaseous elements which move rather more freely because they are gaseous. The more concrete element, like the liquid elements in the body, they move even more slowly. And the bones are, as we say, solid bones. Muscles also we say are solid, but they are very elastic, you see. So the rates of change which can be measured and experienced by us with respect to our bodies are different, and we can sort of differentiate between this and that. But at the same time, we do know that because the body is a whole in which all the elements composing it constitute a single indivisible process, they are all interacting, interdependent, interrelated. Therefore, the change in any one part is also experienced as a change of the whole body, although at a different rate. Now, if you think, try to imagine, imagination is not very helpful here. But if you try to sense universal activity as such, in which what we call ourselves individuals have their part in the whole scheme, if you try to sense that universal activity, you will see that the feeling, the sort of inner conviction that I am I as a separate individual, the feeling of separateness anywhere just disappears. You are aware in terms of the whole changing, in which this changes more quickly than that chair, than that stool, than that wall, and so on. When you see the activity as an activity of wholeness, of totality as such, then the whole idea of any one thing being reborn or reincarnated disappears. That idea disappears, and what do you become aware of? What we call life and death, which in the span of our own personal life we are usually conscious of and always think of as born on such and such a date, 1st of January 1900, you see, lived so long, died on the 31st of December 1999. You see? Well, all that just disappears. Instead of birth being here and death being there, you will become more and more conscious in terms of what actually happens in the creative activity which goes on. The process of transformation is a process of birth-death. What is transformation? It means that the death of that which was this instant, which enabled the new thing to come into being. Otherwise there is no change. And remember that this change that takes place in the actual creative process throughout the universe is an all-change process. Everything changes. But we, with our limited faculties, our limited sensitivities, are unable to register that change. You know how modern physicists, a whole school of modern physicists, have propounded from their scientific mathematical work this conception of the actual nature of matter in the through research in the subatomic world. We still use the word particle, which is an unfortunate thing. We shouldn't say particle, because what is conveyed to our brains by the word particle is entirely different from these particles, which have no characteristics associated with our experience of a particle, something you can pick up, something which is hard, maybe penetrable, maybe impenetrable, and so on, you see. They have propounded this concept that every single particle in its interaction with all particles around it is continuously throwing out virtual particles and what they call virtual particles and immediately reabsorbing them. Now, what is the significance of that? The birth-death process is simultaneous, instantaneous, and the mathematics of that aspect of physics, working out the mathematics of it, they suggest that it takes place approximately at the rate of 100,000,000,000,000,000,000 times a second. 10^23 times a second. Now, can you make a picture in your brain of a rate of vibration which takes place at the speed of 100,000,000,000,000,000,000 times in 1 second? Our consciousness can't keep pace with it. You see? And you see, these virtual particles are new, every one of them. This life-death pulsation, this pulse of creation, is so terrific, of such a nature, that if one's sensitivities, one's inner subtle sensitivity, ever responds in the minutest possible way even to it, you see at once the extraordinary nature of existence, of what we call the life-death process. And you will also see this very important fact, that each time this pulse goes, you see, that which comes into being is new. It's not a reshuffling of the old. It's not like changing about the same old furniture in the room and making a new pattern of furniture arrangement. You see? It's not like that. This pulse of life-death is totally new. You and I, we haven't got the sensitivity to sense this. We haven't got that intellectual power to grasp it. And certainly no imaginative power at all to picture it. Our imaginative power is dependent upon our 5 physical senses as such. And then the process of synthesizing the imaginative process by the mano-vijnana, this is there still, by the mano-vijnana, which makes a particular pattern, which is a mere representation of that which actually happens. You see, that is why I, for one, have totally rejected the popular beliefs and the popular pictures and conceptions associated with the words reborn or reincarnated and so forth. This is the actual nature of universal process. And in this process, therefore, nothing is reborn in our ordinary sense. Now, you may say, but then is it annihilated? It is not annihilated. Absolutely not annihilated. Because that which happens on the smallest possible scale is affecting and is affected by that which happens on the largest possible scale. You see, this is where Zen made a wonderful presentation. Part of the universal process. You see? This is where Zen made a wonderful presentation. The interdiffusion of everything, of every particular with other particulars and with the totality, all in simultaneity. If you can get this sense of simultaneity working inside you, then you will make a remarkable discovery. Within the microcosm is embodied the macrocosm. And the macrocosm, in its turn, includes every microcosm, not as a collection of separate bits. Do remember this. It's not like a bag containing 2,000 chocolates or something, separate chocolates. It's not like that. Its containment is of such a nature that it is interdiffused with everything present. Yes, you may well shut your eyes. These are very, very difficult things to start with to sense, and even more difficult to formulate in any sort of language. I try my best to make it as little misleading as possible, and that is all that one can do in trying to talk of ultimate things and very, very deep things and so on. You see? So now, because there is this interdiffusion, in every split second, split up the second into 100,000 million parts, you see, in every second the totality has changed with you, as you change. So that at the death of the organism, by the time the death of the particular organism comes about, with its development through the 70, 80, 100 years that you may have lived, all the effects of your development have interdiffused with the totality. So nothing is lost. The whole of mankind, just to confine ourselves to mankind for the purpose of making it easier to picture the thing, you see, the whole of mankind has benefited by your what you are, what we call progress, and has suffered regression because of our defects and our wrongdoing and our mistakes and so forth. So what the individual sows during his lifetime, the totality continuously reaps from moment to moment. This is the grand way in which karma works out. There is no ledger account of credits and debts, which is the usual karmic picture. Utterly childish and naive, and I could almost say quite false. There's no such ledger account. The entire universe is reaping the fruits of, in the immediate now, of what is being done, thought, felt, spoken. To think of karma, where individuals are concerned, as working out through time is only an extremely superficial and a misleading way of looking at karma. This question of carrying on the development is necessarily tied up with the idea of karma. And we think in terms of carrying on the development because we cling to the ego in some form or other. We want to reach a goal. There is no goal for me. The trends of life through the different kingdoms of nature, through the different species that are alive in the world, the trends of life can be seen as specialized trends. And as these trends come to fulfillment, the totality, the supreme creative activity, or if you like to use more subjective terms, Brahman or Atma or Ein Sof or the unborn, etc., you see, they have all come to fulfillment in that culmination, which is universal. It's man's souls, if you like to put it in a rather simplistic form, individual man sows, mankind reaps. If you want to make it still more inclusive, the individual man sows and totality reaps. Not you or I. Supposing, in the course of our growth, as we call it, which is a real thing insofar as the changes which take place in us, if they are in tune with the trend of life for mankind, then one can reach what we may not wrongly call a fulfillment for the individual as well as for mankind. But supposing you have reached that fulfillment, supposing you have at last completely purified the psyche, become the perfected Holy One, the enlightened one, the liberated one, what then? Have you finished? Are you stuck there? Not the least bit. Consider, the Buddha left home at 29. When he was 29. They say at 35 he reached enlightenment. Was that the end? Not a bit of it. The Mahayanists state that from 35, the age of 35, till the age of 51, he taught along certain lines and then produced the deeper teachings embodied in the Mahayana. Now, obviously that means that the enlightened one was getting more and more enlightened. There's no stopping. The process is endless. And what does the Buddha himself say? In the Brahmajala Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, towards the end of this long discourse, the Brahmajala is a particularly important sutta. What does he say towards the end? When he is discussing all the different theories about the soul and so forth, and the 62 or 64 types of philosophies which were prevalent then in relationship to this idea of the soul. He points out that they are all short-sighted. And he repeats, after dealing with each group of such philosophies, he repeats again and again. But the Tathagata, having seen this, that and the other which has been present, and knowing that which is beyond, he puts them all aside. You see? And then towards the end he says, the form which you see now living before you, because it has purified itself so that all ill, all clinging to life, all defilements of the mind, all evil qualities have been completely got rid of, made like a palm tree stump, so that it can never again throw out any shoots. You see? A palm tree stump. Therefore, on the death of this form which you see before you, there will be no returning of any such form. Now the old people had certain limitations. When these things were written down and put down, the knowledge of the nature of things had not developed sufficiently far to produce the conceptual and verbal material which would have made it a little more clear to succeeding generations. In this way, in our power of expressing and power of presenting in less misleading terms the deep truths, this has grown, this has gone forward. What we call the eternal verities remain eternal verities. That is to say, eternal verities in terms of the nature of the verity, the qualitative aspect of it. The statement, the formulation is something which invariably, inevitably changes. If that doesn't change, then the human race itself will probably go the way of the dinosaurs. Because the form, the outward form, mankind, will be an outworn form for the activities of the primordial creative energy. So now, we see that there is nothing lost, nothing gained. Nothing gained for the individual, nothing lost for the individual, because the limited individuality itself has completely done its work. It's one with the universal, and the universal continues and has benefited through your virtue, your goodness, your vision, your development. We can say your vision and development quite legitimately, because we are at present living in the space-time context, and within that limited context there is a meaning to the fulfillment and development. But with the complete disappearance of the me, that development and all the effects of it have been affecting the whole universe, just as the whole universe has been affecting us all the time. You see? When one really senses this, think of the wonderful result. There is an extraordinary inner freedom and a peace. We no longer try to pull up the seedling in order to see just how far it has grown. We just live happily, humanly, with dignity, with beauty, with loveliness, with wisdom, and we die in the same way. Instead of that pathetic, miserable little struggle to have life prolonged, that we may develop further or finish the undone work and all the rest of it. You are completely free. You have an inner peace, an inner strength, a true virya, a divine virya, so wonderful that you don't need any consolations. You have given yourself unto the universe from the beginning to the end. And if that isn't a reality, a real meaning of nirvana, what is? You are free of all kinds of limited aspirations, which are self-oriented. You are free of hopes and expectations. And above all, from the Buddhistic point of view, and in terms of Buddhistic values, you are totally free of all grasping. And remember the words of the Buddha himself to Ananda, his beloved disciple. And this, O Ananda, is deathlessness, the complete freedom from all grasping.